Chapter 13 Human Motivations, Management and Related Ideas. Motivation. What is motivation? If you ask most people this question, they might say it is the desire or willingness to engage in work or other activities. When this concept is applied to organizations, the term has a meaning that is not exactly the same. This can be seen in the following definitions of the word motivation taken from the indicated sources. 1. The process of stimulating an individual to take action that will accomplish a desired goal. Montana P. and Charnod B. 1993 Management, 2nd ed. Pages 451. 2. Any influence that brings out, directs, or maintains people's goal-directed behavior. This was a quote Hal Riegel, D. and Slocum, Jr., J.W. 1996 Management, 7th ed. Pages 409. 3. The process through which needs or wants lead to drives aimed at goals or incentives. This was a quote Luthans F. and Hojets R. 1992 Business 2nd ed. Pg 8. 4. The willingness to exert high levels of effort toward organizational goals conditioned by the effort's ability to satisfy some individual need. This was a quote Robbins, S.P. 1996 Organizational Behavior 7th ed. Pages 212. None of these definitions are really good descriptions of the complex motivational process that exists in human beings. Motivation is not really one thing. It is a relative concept that applies to the many different types of behaviors human beings can engage in, and none of these definitions emphasize this fact. Human beings can, and usually are, highly motivated to engage in certain types of behavior at a particular point in time, and they may have little or no motivation to engage in other types of behavior. There are also a number of theories that are more or less part of the study of management theory and organizational behavior, which attempt to explain human motivation in more detail than the simple definitions. These theories will be discussed later in this chapter, but they are not sufficient to explain the highly complex human motivational system. An adequate explanation of the sophisticated motivational processes can be obtained if we turn toward an analysis based on psychology for the next few pages. I will start this discussion with a detailed definition of motivation. Motivation is an emotional or mental response, or desire, that coaxes the individual to engage in a specific type of behavior. There is essentially one type of motivation for each type of behavior, which means essentially that there are almost a limitless variety of motivations. For example, an individual might be highly motivated to engage in recreational sports, but she might lack motivation to work at her assembly line job in the factory. The same individual might be motivated to work at another type of job, such as office work. The above suggests an important principle for managers. An employee that is not motivated to do one type of work might be motivated to do a different type of job. Sometimes even changing the work environment can change motivation. For example, some employees will be more motivated if they work with people or with additional supervision, or vice versa. Motivation can be divided into three basic categories, which are physiological, secondary, and complex. I will discuss these three categories in the following paragraphs. Physiological motivations are motivational responses that human beings and other mammals are born with. These motivations are needed for survival. The physiological motivations can be represented by the following 16 desires, as follows. A desire to attack in anger, verbally or physically. Anger is generally considered an undesirable manifestation in our society. It is the result of frustration, and it can often be avoided by reducing frustrating situations in the work environment. A desire to breathe. This is an obvious motivation, and it was included for the sake of completeness. A desire to avoid cold in general. Workers that are exposed to conditions that make them feel uncomfortably cold will probably work much less efficiently. This applies to office work, studying, and outdoor work. Thus, this is a problem that could and should be avoided with proper heating or proper clothing for outdoor workers. A desire that relates to curiosity. This is a desire to explore and experience new or unusual situations. This motivation is classified here as physiological because behaviors associated with this motivation can be seen in very young children and animals, which suggests that it is innate and not learned. The curiosity motivation also serves a survival function by facilitating the learning process, which is needed to satisfy the other physiological needs. The learning that results from curiosity can lead to innovations, which can lead to easier and more efficient ways of satisfying needs. A desire to defecate. This is an obvious motivation, and it was included for the sake of completeness. a desire to drink water. This is an obvious physiological motivation, which generally is not much of a problem in conventional work environments. However, this motivation can be extremely significant in very hot environments, especially if the employees are engaged in heavy physical labor. An example is construction workers exposed to the summer sun on a very warm day. Such conditions can result in partial dehydration of the body, which can result in a reduction of energy and work rate. This can be coupled with an increased risk of errors and accidents. The partial dehydration that results under such conditions is usually not caused by the unavailability of water. The problem results from a relative deficiency in the motivation to drink water. Actually, this motivation does increase under warm environmental conditions. However, it usually does not increase enough to motivate the individual to drink the large amount of additional water that is needed to replace all the fluid that is lost from perspiration. The solution is to encourage employees exposed to excessively warm temperatures to drink significantly more water than they need to quench their thirst. A desire to eat what an employee ate at her last meal can affect work efficiency and performance. There are no absolute principles in this regard, because human physiology varies with the individual and her established eating habits. However, an excessively heavy meal, especially if it contains much fat, can cause drowsiness and reduce alertness in some individuals. This might result in a reduction in efficiency, as well as an increased risk of errors and accidents. With some individuals, a heavy intake of carbohydrates can have an effect that is more or less similar to the above. However, carbohydrates can have the opposite effect, for some people, which can result in an increase in energy and alertness. This can be especially the case if the employees are engaged in heavy physical activity during the working hours. For some people, skipping breakfast results in lack of energy and a reduction in work efficiency. For other individuals, skipping breakfast has no effect on their energy level, which is likely to be the case for people who are adjusted to this eating pattern as a result of habitually skipping breakfast for a number of years. Weight loss diets can in some cases affect work performance and efficiency. The dieter, in some cases, can have a significantly lowered energy level, which can result in lowered work performance, an increase in errors and accidents. Dieters sometimes become very irritable and difficult to get along with, which can result in a significant disruption of the work environment. This is especially the case if the manager or boss is irritable as a result of a weight loss diet. This irritability can be the result of a lowered blood sugar level, and it can be remedied by taking any liquid that contains sugar, such as orange or apple juice. A similar type of irritability, resulting from lowered blood sugar levels, can manifest in employees that are engaged in heavy physical labor. The same solution, sweet drinks, can remedy the problem, at least temporarily. A desire to exercise. Some individuals might argue that there is no motivation of this nature, because many people dislike physical exercise. However, if we closely examine the evidence from our own experience, it becomes apparent that there really is an exercise motivation in human beings. This becomes apparent if you try to hold your body still for a long period of time. You will experience a desire to move. Even sitting, with little movement, for many hours, can be extremely difficult, tiring and uncomfortable. Most people have a desire to stand up and stretch and take a brief walk after they have been sitting for many hours. Even when most people are sitting, they tend to move their legs, at least a little, even when it is not necessary to move the legs to perform the work they are doing. The exercise motivation is more apparent in children than it is in adults. Children will run, wrestle, jump, even when there is no apparent reason to do so. You can see a similar response in many animals, especially young cats and dogs. This raises the question: what physiological function does the exercise motivation serve? The answer is it helps with blood and lymph circulation, it maintains muscle and heart strength, and it helps maintain alertness. Thus, this motivation serves vital functions, but in spite of its physiological utility, the exercise motivation is severely deprived in many situations, including office work and school studies. The severe deprivation of the exercise motivation is probably a primary factor that makes prolonged office work and school studies extremely uncomfortable for many people. The solution to this problem consists of periodically moving the arms, legs and torso when doing office work or studying. This can also involve periodically performing activities that require movement, such as cleaning the office, or having a short exercise break every hour. A desire to avoid fearful objects and situations. This motivation generally does not have much significance in most conventional work environments. Perhaps, it is significant in certain dangerous occupations, such as in the military, or police force. In such cases, the individual is usually expected to perform the duties in spite of the fear. A desire to avoid pain. This motivation serves an important function, which involves warning the animal or human when physiological damage is occurring. The pain sensation can be counterproductive when an individual cannot escape from it, such as when there is internal physiological damage or a disease-related condition. Employees that are suffering from pain, including the common headache, are likely to work with a reduction in efficiency and have difficulty concentrating. However, if they manage to concentrate on their work, in spite of the pain, the uncomfortable pain sensations will be temporarily reduced or eliminated. The reason for this is it is more or less necessary to concentrate on a sensation to experience it. If the concentration is switched away from the pain toward work, the employee will usually experience less discomfort. This technique is used in hypnosis to reduce pain. A desire to rest. This motivation can increase by working conditions that are monotonous, very warm or cold, or involve a great deal of physical exertion. The first three conditions mentioned could and should be corrected. When working conditions involve a great deal of physical exertion, provisions should be made for periodic rest breaks. A desire for sex. This motivation manifests in many forms, and is not limited to sexual intercourse. In the contemporary work environment, this motivation can cause many problems when it isn't properly channeled, such as in the form of sexual harassment. With changes in philosophy and perspective in recent years, even a friendly compliment about physical appearance, harmless flirting, or a legitimate request for a date can be misinterpreted as sexual harassment if it comes from a male coworker to a female employee. This misinterpretation is probably more likely to happen if the male is a superior. A desire to sleep. This motivation generally should not manifest in the typical work environment. However, when employees do not get enough sleep, there is a high probability that sleepiness will be a problem. This can be a significant problem on night shifts, especially when workers are periodically switched from day work to night work. The problem can be worsened by lack of mental stimulation and inadequate supervision, which can result in sleeping on the job. An even worse situation can result when the job is potentially dangerous, such as driving a truck. The problem can be reduced by careful supervision and sending sleepy workers home. Employees that repeatedly show up for work sleepy, which can happen as a result of poor sleeping habits or working two shifts, perhaps should be sent home without receiving any pay for the work they did not provide. A desire for mental stimulation. This motivation is classified here as physiological because behaviors associated with this motivation can be seen in very young children and animals, which suggests that it is innate and not learned. Total deprivation of this motivation will result in extreme discomfort, and in some cases even hallucinations. Mild deprivation results in boredom or sleepiness. The mental stimulation motivation serves a vital survival function by facilitating the learning process. The learning process is needed to learn how to satisfy the physiological survival needs, especially how to obtain food, water, shelter, and avoid danger. An understanding of this motivation can be used by managers to increase the desirability of certain jobs by making them mentally stimulating. This can sometimes be done by job expansion, which involves increasing the variety of tasks involved with a job and/or increasing the responsibilities associated with the job. A desire to urinate. This is an obvious physiological need, which is placed here for the sake of completeness. A desire to avoid uncomfortably warm temperatures. Warm temperatures can reduce work efficiency and increase the rates of accidents and errors. This is especially the case with work that requires much physical exertion, such as construction work. The problem of warm temperatures can be a severe problem when the work is being done outdoors in bright sunlight. A solution is thin clothing that is very light in color, frequent breaks in an indoor air-conditioned facility, and a large amount of drinking water. In modern indoor environments, warm temperatures are seldom a problem because of modern air conditioning. From the above list, it is apparent that the biological motivations can be divided into two basic categories, which are avoidance-related and goal-seeking. The avoidance-related motivations are a desire to avoid cold, a desire to avoid fearful objects and situations, a desire to avoid pain, and a desire to avoid uncomfortably warm temperatures. When these motivations are activated, we feel discomfort, which can be followed by relief when the motivation is satisfied. The remainder of the items on the above list are all goal-seeking motivations, such as a desire to drink water, a desire to eat, a desire for sex. When these motivations are in the process of being satisfied, we feel pleasure. The amount of discomfort, pleasure, and desire that an individual experiences in relation to a specific physiological motivation varies as a result of the following six factors. the unique physiology of the individual. For example, some individuals are probably born with a relatively strong desire to engage in physical exercise. Other individuals may have a very weak desire to exercise. The same basic idea would probably apply to all of the physiological motivations. The unique psychology of the individual, as it developed from the learning process and influence of socio-cultural experiences human beings learn from their social and cultural environments, which includes their family, neighbors and friends. What they learn can probably reduce or increase the desire to engage in a specific physiological motivation. For example, an individual that comes from a culture that has many taboos against sexual behavior might develop some aversions toward her own sexual desires and behavior, which can reduce the relative strength of this physiological motivation, as measured in behavioral terms. Another example is an individual that comes from a culture that encourages eating relatively large amounts of food will probably develop the habit of overeating, which might also be coupled with deriving much pleasure from food. The current state of physical health of the individual illness can interfere with certain physiological motivations under some conditions. For example, a sick person might have a reduced desire to eat and a loss of desire for sexual activity. The current emotional state of the individual. The emotional state can affect physiological motivations in ways that are unique to the specific individual, as measured by behavior. For example, some people eat less if they are depressed or upset, but there are people who will eat considerably more than usual under the same conditions. The age of the individual. Age appears to influence the levels of the various physiological motivations. The following are general examples involving two physiological motivations, which are presented together for brevity. Most young children have a very strong desire to engage in some type of physical exercise, which manifests in terms of various types of play. As they grow older, into adolescence and young adulthood, their desire for physical exercise might be reduced, but their desire for sexual activity increases. As people grow into middle age and beyond, usually desires for physical activity and sexual activity gradually decline. However, an older person might force themselves to exercise to maintain health. The interval of time between satisfying the motivation. The longer the time interval between satisfying a motive, the stronger it will usually be, and vice versa. A physiological motive that is very frequently satisfied will generally be relatively weak. For example, if an individual did not eat for many hours, she will be very hungry. A person that ate a large meal an hour ago will obviously not be very hungry. The physiological motivations often cannot be satisfied directly or immediately, or in the most ideal way, which is especially true for human beings living in a modern society. The individual must learn how to satisfy her needs within the framework of the physical environment and the beliefs, traditions, norms, values, and laws imposed on the individual by her society and culture. Much of this learning takes place in the socialization process, which starts at infancy and continues throughout the developing years, and may continue to some extent throughout life. For example, people are not permitted to eat or sleep when they are being paid to work. Another obvious example are the many restrictive and controlling norms for proper sexual behavior. The process of satisfying physiological needs through a process that deals with environmental, social and cultural realities results in secondary motivations. That is, I am defining secondary motivations for this text as a desire to satisfy one or more physiological needs by performing a set of actions. If the individual is reasonably well adjusted to the realities she faces, the set of actions will be adequate to satisfy the physiological need as under the environmental, social, and cultural conditions that the individual is faced with. For example, a well-adjusted adult living in our society might seek employment to earn money to satisfy many of the physiological motivations that were mentioned above, such as the desire to eat, a desire to avoid cold, by purchasing clothes and obtaining adequate housing, a desire for mental stimulation, etc. Another example of a secondary motivation is the desire to socialize. Socializing with others can satisfy the need for mental stimulation, and for single individuals it can serve the need for mate selection. Complex motivations are motivations that cannot easily be broken down into a simple set of physiological desires. This concept leaves room for the possibility that all motivation might not be ultimately derived from physiological motivations. However, complex motivations are probably secondary motivations in most, if not all cases, but the primary physiological motivations involved are not totally apparent. Complex motivations can be made up of a series of simpler secondary motivations in some cases. Whether a motivation in a specific individual is classified as secondary or complex is determined by whether or not the motivation can be easily traced to physiological needs, as based on the definitions presented above. The development of complex motivations, just as is the case with secondary motivations, involves learning, especially the learning that takes place in the socialization process. Examples of complex motivations include a desire for friendship, desires to engage in certain hobbies, desire for social status, desires to be liked or loved, desires for achievement, or any motivation that does not easily fall into the classification of physiological or secondary motivation. From the above paragraphs, it is apparent that we all have the same basic physiological motivations, but the degree of strength of these motivations varies with the individual and circumstances that the individual is faced with. It is probably also apparent that people do not necessarily have identical secondary and complex motivations. However, individuals that live in the same society, come from similar cultural backgrounds, are of the same social class, age, and sex are likely to have many similar but not identical secondary and complex motivations. This is the case, because secondary and complex motivations develop as a result of the learning processes that take place in the socio-cultural environment. Whatever the type of motivation is, there is usually many ways that a specific motivation is satisfied. Each individual has a unique way of satisfying physiological, secondary, and complex motivations. This is the result of the learning processes that take place in the socio-cultural environment coupled with the unique experiences of each individual. For example, one individual might satisfy her need for mental stimulation by watching television, and another individual might satisfy the same need by socializing with friends, and still another individual might satisfy her need for mental stimulation by working on challenging physics problems. The above can also be looked at in terms of complex needs, where one person has a need to watch television, another individual has a need to socialize, and another individual has a need to solve physics problems. These needs are intrinsic, as opposed to extrinsic, with the example and hypothetical individuals discussed above. The above raises the question, what are intrinsic and extrinsic needs? Intrinsic needs or intrinsic motivations are desires that are internal in nature and are not performed for any external reward. That is, intrinsic motivations or needs motivate behaviors that result in relief, pleasure, and/or satisfaction. Examples are an individual that likes to play chess, an amateur photographer who enjoys photography as a hobby, an individual who is eating a tasty meal, a person that is going to sleep to obtain relief from fatigue. Extrinsic means more or less the opposite of the above. That is, extrinsic motivations or needs are behaviors that are carried out for an external reward, such as money, a compliment, prestige, attainment of a goal. Thus, extrinsic motivations are not just related to money. The concept applies to any type of external reward or goal. An individual that works at an unpleasant, boring job for money is an example of an extrinsic motivation. Another example is an individual that is attending college and spending many hours studying to obtain a high-paying job after graduation. However, the student might also be obtaining some intrinsic pleasure by attending college. Motivations are often both intrinsic and extrinsic in nature. For example, most people get some enjoyable mental stimulation from their employment. They might also enjoy the company of the people directly associated with their job, and experience many other intrinsic pleasures at work. However, their primary reason for working is usually the extrinsic reward of money. Another example is an individual that networks while socializing in a recreational environment, with the primary intrinsic goal of enjoying the interaction with people, and the secondary goal of obtaining clients. Note, Abraham Maslow originally offered the basic idea discussed in the following paragraph, and his theory, which postulated a hierarchy of needs. This hierarchy relates to the relative degree of importance and dominance of the various needs, which was meant to apply to most if not all human beings. However, the perspective I am presenting below assumes that each individual has her own personal hierarchy of needs. This can be called the theory of the personal hierarchy of needs. This is significantly different from Maslow's original idea. Maslow's original theory will be discussed in detail later on in this chapter. End of note. Thus, needs can be intrinsic, extrinsic, or a combination of both of these components. However, whatever the nature of a need, it has a relative degree of importance, in comparison with other needs, in the personal life of a specific individual. That is, some needs are more important to a specific individual than other needs. This does not imply that the individual will only focus on the need that is most important to her, but with some individuals there is an extreme focus on one or two unsatisfied needs. Most individuals will consider the basic physiological needs that are required to maintain life to be of primary importance. If there is a serious difficulty in satisfying these needs, most individuals will neglect the less important needs, such as desires for academic and social development, and focus their time, money, and efforts on the needs required to maintain life. However, each individual has a unique priority, or personal hierarchy of needs. For example, some individuals will consider personal development, in terms of cultural, social, psychological, educational, and employment opportunities for high-status occupations, as an extremely important need. This hypothetical individual would consider personal development more important than material possessions. However, such an individual might change their focus if they achieve the personal development goals that they are striving to obtain. In general, each individual has their own system of priorities in relation to needs, which can be called a personal hierarchy of needs. The relative degree of importance that an individual places on a specific need in their hierarchy is determined by all of the following. The cultural upbringing of the individual, especially in relation to social class. Each culture and social class more or less has their own hierarchy of needs. People learn values that relate to this hierarchy from the socialization process during their developing years. For example, an individual from a working class environment may have learned to focus first on money and material possessions, and second on advanced education and personal development. An individual from a highly educated upper middle class environment may have been taught to focus on education and personal development before focusing on money and material possessions. In general, the rewards individuals seek from employment are probably partly determined by their cultural and social class upbringing. A manager can probably put this information to good use by studying the employees and learning what cultural and social class they are from and what rewards they value. This information might be useful to help you determine what appropriate job incentives might be. For example, a working class individual might consider a small raise in a new machine to reduce the workload as an excellent reward. An upper middle class person might consider an advancement to a higher job position as a significant reward, even if the work was more difficult and even if it was not accompanied by an immediate pay increase. Note, of course, social class and culture cannot be used by itself to determine the needs and desires of a specific individual. Individuals can develop needs, desires, goals and interests that are significantly different from the average person from their social class and culture. However, social class and culture can sometimes be used as a starting point in understanding a specific group of employees. The primary point to keep in mind in this regard includes the following. The ideas we have about a specific culture and social class can be incorrect. A specific individual can be significantly different than the other members of her sociocultural group, as far as needs, values and goals are concerned. End a note. The social class or cultural group that the individual perceives herself to be a part of the social and cultural group that the individual associates herself with in adult life, can affect her personal hierarchy of needs in very significant ways. Thus, the personal hierarchy of needs might change as an individual changes her social or cultural identification. The personal philosophy and unique psychological development of the individual. Each individual has a unique personal philosophy and psychological makeup. This can influence how the individual's personal hierarchy of needs develop. The relative degree of success or failure in satisfying specific needs. If an individual has been highly successful in satisfying a specific need, such as a desire to become wealthy, she might focus on other needs, such as on personal development. In addition, if an individual totally failed to obtain a specific need, such as a desire to become wealthy, she might give up and focus on other needs, such as enjoying the simple pleasures of life, or she might get involved in personal development efforts. The point is, human beings are all unique individuals. They do have similar physiological needs, but the relative strength of their physiological desires varies with the individual. As far as secondary and complex needs are concerned, the variations from one individual to another are even greater. In the above paragraphs, we discussed physiological, secondary, complex motivations, as well as intrinsic and extrinsic motivations, and the personal hierarchy of needs. Question: what is missing from this discussion? If we engage in some self-analysis, the answer might come to us. There are things we enjoy doing, which by definition are intrinsically motivating. There are tasks and situations that fall into the opposite category. That is, there are certain things we simply hate to do, and certain situations we do not want to manifest or be involved with. These tasks and situations are unpleasant, negatively rewarding or penalizing in nature. The above concept can be defined as negatively motivating. We can also conclude that there are negative motivations, which are tasks and situations we want to avoid, because they are intrinsically or extrinsically unpleasant or counterproductive. We can also list undesirable tasks and situations in terms of a personal hierarchy of negative motivations. This has the basic similarities of the personal hierarchy of needs. With negative motivations, there is a hierarchy of negative tasks and situations, with varying degrees of their potential to dominate our attention and efforts. For an example of a personal hierarchy of negative motivations, I will use a hypothetical individual, which represents a typical human being living in our society, and I will call her Ms. X. Major physiological malfunctions of her body, such as severe pain, severe illness, and medical conditions that appear to be leading to death, are the most dominant and disruptive conditions Ms. X can face. If Ms. X is faced with such a situation, she is likely to do everything she can to alleviate the negative condition, if she does not get depressed and give up. Severe disabling illness that is not likely to be fatal is second on Ms. X's hierarchy of negative motivations. The loss of a major relationship such as in divorce is third. The loss of a large amount of personal property, such as losing a house and furniture in a fire, is fourth. The loss of employment or expulsion from school is fifth in Ms. X's hierarchy of negative needs. A major house cleaning effort is seventh on Ms. X's list. It is possible to list many unpleasant tasks, for 8, 9, 10, etc. Of course, the above is an example involving a hypothetical individual, and the idea to keep in mind is that each individual has in effect a personal list of situations and tasks that they consider to be distasteful, and will exert effort to avoid. Thus, tasks that are on an individual's hierarchy of negative motivations, tasks the employee truly dislikes, should not be assigned to that individual. If it is, it will require much willpower on the part of the employee to complete the task, and much time from the supervisor to motivate the employee to work on the task. Much of the practical information that can be derived from the material that was presented in this chapter, thus far, can be delineated and summed up with the following questions. Are there any ways you can make the situation or job more pleasant? What are all the possible ways that you might be able to make the job or situation intrinsically more rewarding? What are all the ways that you can make the situation or job extrinsically more rewarding? Can you make the job or situation more mentally stimulating in a positive sense? What are the needs of Ms. X, and or what are the needs of Ms. X in relation to the work environment? Ms. X, of course, stands for any individual, such as the employees that a manager is supervising. Then the needs should be listed in order of importance. What are the negative motivations as far as Ms. X is concerned? Are there any negative motivations interfering with Ms. X's work performance? If so, what are all the possible ways the difficulty might be circumvented? What are the tasks in the work environment that Ms. X dislikes the most? Can these tasks be changed so Ms. X will not find them so distasteful? Can the unpleasant tasks be reassigned to an individual that does not perceive the tasks as excessively unpleasant? If you are dealing with a number of employees, a list of needs and negative motivations from each employee can be helpful in understanding each individual. It can also be helpful in providing appropriate work incentives. The above idea can also be useful in understanding and dealing with people in general, such as your supervisor, co-workers, wife, husband, mother, father, sister, brother, friend, etc. Understanding their needs and negative motivations can facilitate a better relationship and help avoid conflict. The above raises the question: how do you obtain a list of needs and negative motivations from the individual as you are dealing with? One method is simply to ask them the appropriate questions such as the following. What do you like to do best? What do you enjoy most? And or list the tasks you do not mind doing and list the tasks you dislike. Another method of understanding an individual's needs and negative motivations is to observe them and evaluate their responses. The observations can be confirmed or reinforced with appropriate questions, such as: do you mind performing the task? Do you like this job? This task appears to be giving you some difficulty. Do you want me to give you another job? Motivation from a practical perspective in the work environment. To this point, the discussion was primarily focused on a general theoretical perspective of motivation, which only occasionally focused on the motivation of employees in an organizational setting. The question that was not answered is: how can the motivation of employees be increased? Job-related motivation can generally be improved by the 9 numbered points presented in the following paragraphs. 1. Obtain employees that will not be overburdened by the goals you will be setting. That is, it is important to be certain that the employees you are choosing have the physical capabilities, mental abilities, skills, personality, and temperament that are needed to perform the tasks without an unreasonable amount of effort and stress. If an employee is exerting an extreme and unreasonable effort to obtain job-related goals, it might mean that she is not qualified for the specific tasks that she is performing, even if she is reaching the goals. Such an inability can become apparent from observations and repeated complaints from the employee. In such a case, it might be better to find an employee that can perform the same task with less effort. The points to keep in mind in regard to the above are as follows. It is much easier to motivate employees to perform tasks that they can do with a reasonable amount of effort. Sometimes problems with motivation are connected to relative deficiencies or weaknesses in job-related abilities and skills. Motivation problems can also be the result of a temperament or personality that is simply inappropriate for the job. When employees are assigned to jobs that are reasonably challenging, but well within their abilities and skills and appropriate for their temperament and personality, they will have to exert less effort to perform the job-related tasks. This usually will mean that it will be easier to motivate them to carry out the job-related goals. 2. Set reasonably challenging goals. Set goals that are precise enough to be clearly perceived or measured when achieved. Setting imprecise goals, such as telling an employee to do your best, or do as much as you can, is less effective, and it might even be counterproductive in some cases. One of the reasons for this is imprecise goals do not represent precise expectations and performance standards. Imprecise goals, such as do your best, can be consciously or unconsciously misinterpreted as do as much as you want to do, or take it easy, or I do not care how little or how much work you do. In addition, imprecise goals can suggest that there will be no penalty for inadequate work performance, and it gives the employee an excellent excuse for a poor work output. The employee can always say I did my best, no matter how inadequate her effort and work performance may have been. When precise goals are set, the implication is that there will be adverse consequences for not obtaining the goals, which can provide the motivation needed to work faster and more precisely. Setting precise goals transmits the message that you care about the production rate and quality. However, there are situations where it is almost impossible, or even inappropriate, or counterproductive to set precise goals. General examples where goal setting might be inappropriate are when dealing with professionals who are working with unpredictable situations, such as in research, or when dealing with creative people who are highly motivated. In such cases, the employees can set their own goals with consultation with management. 3. Try and explain the purpose and ultimate utility of rules, procedures, methods, tasks, sub-goals, and goals in many work situations. The employees performing tasks that are a part of a larger organizational effort. This can totally disguise the purpose and meaning of the task. The employee might understand what she is supposed to do, but she may not have any idea of the reason or purpose of her work. An extreme example of this can often be found on the assembly line. This can involve an employee soldering wires together in an electronic component, with no knowledge of the ultimate purpose of the component. A similar situation can sometimes be found in the office. This can involve a clerk that is required to follow precise regulations and fill out forms in a certain way, without any understanding of the purpose of the forms or the regulations. Situations of this nature can reduce employee motivation. In extreme cases, the employee might believe part of the work assigned to her is totally irrational or unnecessary. This can motivate the employee to neglect the work she believes is irrational when the supervisor is not watching her. A similar situation can happen with safety rules when there is an inadequate understanding of the need for such rules. The solution is to explain the reason for rules, procedures, methods, tasks, sub-goals, and goals in terms of a meaningful organizational effort in a way that the employee can understand. In most situations, the better the understanding, the better the work performance will be. In addition, such understanding can increase the quality of the work, because if the employee understands the purpose behind her effort, she is probably more likely to understand the consequences of inadequate work. The understanding might also give her the knowledge to spot defects at an early stage. 4. Provide appropriate supervision. Without appropriate supervision, there is the risk that employees will not follow rules and neglect much of their work. Some employees need little supervision and others need a great deal of supervisory observation. However, there should be supervision and related assessment of work performance in almost all cases. If this is neglected, there is a risk that even highly disciplined professional employees will not perform their jobs adequately. Lack of supervision, especially in a large organization, can send the message that nobody cares about the quality or quantity of your work. This raises the question, how can appropriate supervision be provided? There are many direct and indirect ways of providing appropriate supervision. A few examples are as follows. Constant observation by a supervisor or foreman. This is a common method, and it can be highly effective. Unexpected periodic observation. The problem with this method, when used alone, is a sizable percentage of employees might not be doing their work in an adequate way. They might be willing to gamble, with the assumption that they are not likely to be caught breaking rules or not working. Random and unexpected examination of a sample of the product produced by a worker. This can be used with many types of products. It can also be useful for certain types of services that result in documentation, such as bookkeeping or accounting. In such a case, a sample of the documentation is examined. Team members monitoring their own performance. This method involves a number of people working together and supervising their own work. The difficulty with this method is the entire team might decide to work slowly and focus their efforts on idle conversation. Perhaps, it is best if this method is used with other techniques to avoid this possibility. It is an effective method when used under appropriate conditions with motivated employees. Video observation of employees. Some employees might think this is an invasion of privacy, but this complaint is not really valid if the employees are aware that there is a video monitoring system at the work site. Computer monitoring of the work performance of employees. This technique has much potential. It has been used with office workers, where it is relatively easy to connect office equipment to computer monitoring devices. Unfortunately, the technique can cause excessive stress on employees in some cases. This can probably be minimized by providing adequate breaks and informing employees that reasonable standards of work performance are expected. Management by walking around. This basically involves a manager walking around and observing and casually talking to people in the work environment. A combination of one or more of the above. Most of the above techniques are likely to be more functional if they are used in a combination that is appropriate for the specific set of circumstances. All of these methods can be used in an appropriate or inappropriate way. Too much supervision, especially if it is coupled with much criticism, can in some cases be counterproductive or even insulting, and it can cause excessive stress on employees. 5. Provide appropriate assistance. Supervision is likely to be tolerated better if employees learn that the manager will directly or indirectly provide assistance for the employees when it is needed, such as in the following situations. When employees are inadvertently given an unreasonable amount of work, or tasks that are exceedingly difficult, assistance should be provided to reduce the employee's burden to reasonable levels. When employees become ill, even if it is only a headache, some assistance should be provided. This can range from a break, allowing the employee to leave early, providing another employee to do some of the work that the ill employee is having difficulty doing, providing first aid, or calling for professional medical assistance in serious cases. When an employee is confused about an organizational-related situation, method, procedure, etc., appropriate explanations should be provided. When an employee is emotionally upset, even if it is not job-related, providing a sympathetic ear can be quite beneficial. When employees come to a superior with any type of difficulty, appropriate and sympathetic assistance should be provided. Providing friendly assistance can facilitate good relationships between management and employees. This is likely to increase the motivation of the workers in relation to good job performance. 6. Make the work environment as pleasant and rewarding as possible. Try to make it pleasant and easy for the employees to carry out the job-related tasks. Try and design jobs so they are mentally stimulating and enjoyable, if possible. Consider the feasibility of expanding the job in such a way to make it more pleasant and mentally stimulating for the specific employees that you are supervising. However, it is necessary to keep in mind that expanding a job in a specific way does not necessarily make it more pleasant or mentally stimulating for a specific employee. What one employee considers an improvement in the job, another employee might consider a worsening of working conditions. That is, the additional tasks associated with expanded jobs are sometimes considered to be an unpleasant burden by employees. Thus, for job expansion to be truly effective, you must discuss the issue with the employees involved to determine what they consider to be an improvement. A temporary trial of the expanded job can help employees and management determine what is an improvement and what is an unfair burden for employees. An improvement, from the perspective of the employees, will probably involve a reduction in the time spent on conventional job-related tasks when new tasks are assigned. In some cases, the opposite of job expansion might be appropriate. This can involve a reduction in the number of unpleasant job-related tasks and responsibilities. This can be determined by talking to the employees and by experimentation. 7. Do not insult or upset employees. An angry or annoyed employee is not likely to be a motivated worker. The negative emotions can also interfere with the work of all who perceive the negative emotional responses. Unfortunately, managers or co-workers can inadvertently insult or upset employees. People often do not like to be supervised and told what to do, and when to do it. Unfortunately, this is often necessary in the organizational setting. Sometimes other employees will mistreat a worker intentionally or inadvertently. 8. Provide appropriate feedback. Providing employees with job-related feedback can motivate them to work harder, correct inadequacies, and to improve overall work performance. Providing feedback also sends the message that someone cares about the work performance, and that someone is monitoring the quality and quantity of work. There are two basic types of feedback. One type involves giving positive statements about work performance, such as "that is very good. Continue to improve your work performance along these lines." The other type of feedback involves negative statement, such as criticism of poor work performance. General feedback about overall work performance should be given relatively frequently and periodically throughout the year. Specific feedback about task performance, errors, deviations from rules, should be given immediately, such as soon as an error is noticed. 9. Provide appropriate rewards for achieving the goal. As when employees are given goals and rewarded when they obtain the goals, it is likely to increase their motivation in most work environments. Rewards can range from a smile, a compliment, a small present, an opportunity to leave work early, a bonus, a promotion, etc. The employee should be informed that she is receiving the reward for achieving a specific goal. Such information will probably facilitate good work performance in the future. Popular models and ideas in relation to human motivation. Abraham Maslow's theory on the hierarchy of needs. One of the most popular models of human motivation is Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs. According to this theory, there are 5 categories of needs, which are 1. Physiological, 2. Safety, 3. Social, 4. Esteem, and 5. Self-actualization. These need categories form a hierarchy of importance in terms of a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sequence. The example in the following paragraph will clarify this idea. If an individual is faced with life circumstances that results in unsatisfied physiological needs, the individual will focus her efforts on physiological needs, at the expense of the other needs on the list. If the life circumstances change, and the physiological needs are satisfied, the individual will focus on safety needs. If the life circumstances improve further, and safety is no longer a problem, the individual will focus on social needs. If circumstances improve to the point where the social needs are satisfied, the individual will focus on esteem needs. If esteem needs eventually become satisfied in the person's life, the individual will focus on needs that relate to self-actualization. The above suggests the question: what precisely do the 5 classifications mean? This is answered in the following list. 1. The meaning of physiological needs is the same as previously defined, which includes hunger, thirst, sex, etc. 2. Safety needs include needs that relate to physical and psychological security and safety. 3. Social needs include needs for acceptance by others, social affiliation, the need to belong to a larger social group, a need for friendships, etc. 4. Esteem needs are essentially desires that relate to self-esteem, such as achievement, autonomy, a positive recognition and attention from others, self-respect, etc. 5. Self-actualization is essentially a need for personal development, which involves developing abilities, becoming educated, personal growth, higher emotional adjustment, and general self-fulfillment. The above raises the obvious question: does Maslow's hierarchy of need theory work? That is, does it predict reality? If we think about this question, we can provide answers from our own knowledge and experience. There appears to be a rough tendency for human motivations to more or less follow the pattern suggested by Maslow. To take an extreme example, a person that is deprived of a physiological need to breathe will most likely focus on that need only. If an individual is starving, that person will probably focus all her efforts on obtaining food. It also appears that very poor people focus on the essentials of life, such as the physiological and safety needs, and they give little attention to esteem and self-actualization. The poor might also focus on social needs, because it facilitates obtaining the physiological and safety needs. If the poor focus on personal development, it will probably be in the form of education to get themselves out of poverty. It also appears that upper middle class and wealthy people, who have their physiological needs met, focus on the higher needs, such as esteem and self-actualization. The rough tendency for human motivation to follow the hierarchy of need theory is often based on financial necessity. For example, an individual that has her physiological needs deprived is not likely to have the money or energy to invest in the satisfaction of other needs. People that focus on esteem needs and self-actualization are likely to have the energy and money to pay for all of their needs. Self-actualization can be expensive if it involves higher education, personal development workshops, or psychotherapists. Thus, from the above it does appear that Maslow's hierarchy of need theory is more or less consistent with reality. However, if we examine our experiences further, we will find that the theory often fails. There are people who focus on one of the needs in the hierarchy in a way that is inconsistent with Maslow's theory. Many of us probably knew some individuals who focused on self-actualization at the expense of all other needs, such as a highly creative individual trying to develop her skills in a specific area of interest. Most of us probably knew a few teenagers or young adults who focused most of their efforts on socializing, at the expense of everything else. Most people more or less focus on a number of needs. For example, a college student might focus equally on social, esteem, and self-actualization needs. This is probably typical of most people in our modern society. People that are highly adjusted will probably focus, more or less, equally on all five need categories. The above raises the question, what does research suggest about Maslow's theory? The following quote, from Robbins's Organizational Behavior, sums up the general idea that I saw in many of the sources I consulted. Maslow's need theory has received wide recognition, particularly among practicing managers. This can be attributed to the theory's intuitive logic and ease of understanding. Unfortunately, however, research does not generally validate the theory. Maslow provided no empirical substantiation, and several studies that sought to validate the theory found no support for it. This was a quote. The apparent deficiency in Maslow's hierarchy of need theory is the result of its general nature. Human beings are highly complex organisms. Each individual has her own unique physiology, psychological makeup, and is generally a member of a specific culture, subculture, and society. This simply means each person is different from every other person. It also means that each person has their own personal hierarchy of needs, which is likely to be quite different from the hierarchy Maslow suggested. This idea of personal hierarchy of needs was discussed in detail earlier in this chapter. The ERG theory Clayton Alderfer attempted to modify Maslow's theory to make it more consistent with research. This modified theoretical perspective consists of only three need categories, which are 1. Existence, 2. Relatedness, and 3. Growth. It is called the ERG theory, based on the first letters of the three need categories. The first category, existence, consists of needs that more or less relate to maintaining existence. This includes the physiological and safety needs, earning a living, which involves pay, fringe benefits, and working conditions. The second need category, relatedness, consists of social needs and can also include esteem needs that relate to social interactions, such as a desire to interact with others in a way that facilitates self-esteem, a desire to win social acceptance and social status. The last category, growth, is a need for creativity, to make significant contributions to society, and to engage in personal development. This also can involve the esteem-related components as it relates to personal development. Another way of looking at this is successful personal development can facilitate the development of self-esteem. This is essentially equivalent to Maslow's self-actualization coupled with some of the intrinsic esteem needs. The ERG theory is not a rigid step-by-step absolute hierarchy of needs. It is in a sense a flexible hierarchy, with existence needs being the most basic, followed by relatedness needs, with growth needs being at the highest level. Its flexible hierarchy allows for the real-life situations, where a person can be involved in 1, 2, or all 3 need categories. It also states that an individual at a higher need level can go back to a lower need level under certain circumstances, such as when attempts at obtaining higher order needs are frustrated. The flexibility of the ERG theory makes it easy to accept as a valid theory. We know from experience that people can switch from one need level to another in an increasing order as outlined in the theory's hierarchy. We also know that people can be working on a number of need levels simultaneously. We also know that people can attempt a higher order growth need and switch back to a need that is one level lower if they are frustrated. Not surprisingly, the ERG theory has significantly more support, including some scientific studies, than Maslow's hierarchy of needs. The following quote from Robbins's Organizational Behavior is typical. ERG theory is more consistent with our knowledge of individual differences among people. Variables such as education, family background, and cultural environment can alter the importance or driving force that a group of needs holds for a particular individual. The evidence demonstrating that people in other cultures rank the need categories differently, for instance, natives of Spain and Japan place social needs before their physiological requirements, would be consistent with ERG theory. Several studies have supported the ERG theory, but there is also evidence that it doesn't work in some organizations. Overall, however, ERG theory represents a more valid version of the need hierarchy. This was a quote. In spite of the fact that the ERG theory has some scientific support, the theory's structure suggests some deficiencies. Human beings are unique individuals, and they do not follow any specific pattern, and even the flexible hierarchy will probably fail in many individual cases. This is apparent from the next to the last sentence in the above quote. This was a quote. There is also evidence that it doesn't work in some organizations. This was a quote. There might be some statistical support for certain patterns, but this does not mean that the theory is precise enough to predict the behavior of individual employees or human beings in a truly accurate and practical way. However, as an approximation tool of human motivation, the ERG theory is probably a useful device in many situations. McClellan theory of needs. This theory is based on three needs, which are achievement, power, and affiliation. These needs are described in the following list. A need for achievement is a desire to perform or create in a way that is superior to the standards maintained by other people. Individuals that are high in this need invest a considerable amount of effort to obtain success. Individuals in this category prefer situations where they have challenging goals that are realistic. They may dislike very easy or extremely difficult goals. They prefer situations where they can get immediate feedback in relation to their performance. Individuals in this category appear to be excellent employees for many challenging jobs, such as occupations involving the selling of expensive items. The need for power is a desire to control, manipulate people, and make them behave in a predetermined or desired way. Individuals that are high in this trait prefer situations where they have the opportunity to influence people, and they like to be in charge. They like status positions, and prefer competition. Individuals in this category might be good managers in some situations, but they might focus much of their efforts at satisfying their power need, at the expense of good performance. The need for affiliation is a desire to interact with others in a friendly way, and a desire to form close relationships. Individuals that have high affiliation needs prefer cooperation to competition. They like to work in situations where they have the opportunity to create relationships with others. Individuals high in affiliation needs will probably be good employees in any job that requires friendliness and understanding. However, some individuals in this category might focus on friendly socializing at the expense of job performance. The very structure of McClellan theory of needs makes it a realistic and potentially valuable tool. The theory does not contain any unreasonable assumptions about human nature. It simply suggests that there are people who have high levels of either achievement, power, or affiliation. Not surprisingly, the theory does have some empirical support. Perhaps it might be interesting to point out that most people probably have a mixture of the three needs, achievement, power, and affiliation. With some individuals, the relative degree of manifestation of these needs might depend on the environmental conditions they are faced with. The following examples will clarify this idea. An individual that gets a high sales commission to sell items that are very expensive, in a highly competitive environment, might display a high achievement motive. This can be the result of the required behaviors associated with the job, which is facilitated by the high commission. An individual that is placed in a situation where she is in a supervisory position will need to use various types of power to perform her job, which will involve controlling other people. An individual that is in a political occupation, where she must win votes in a competitive election, will have great affiliation needs, as a result of the very nature of the job. That is, a politician that is friendly to voters, other politicians, and people with money and power will probably have a much better chance of remaining in office than an unfriendly politician. Conclusion and problem-solving questions. From the above paragraphs, it is probably apparent that human motivation is extremely complex. The motivations of employees, or the people you are interacting with, can be in conflict with your needs or the needs of your organization. Thus, many problems can manifest in relation to human motivations. The following questions can be used in the creative sense to solve problems related to human motivation. What is the nature of the motivational problem that you are dealing with? Are you sure that there are not other factors involved besides motivation? What type of motivation S relates to the problem you are working on? Are there any physiological, secondary, and/or complex motivations involved with your problem? What are all the possible ways of correcting the problem S? What are the secondary and complex needs of the individuals you are dealing with? What is the personal hierarchy of needs of the individual S you are working with? What culture and social class are the employees you are working with from, and what intrinsic and extrinsic rewards do they value? How can you use this information to provide appropriate job incentives? What are the needs of your employees? What are the needs of your customers? What are the needs of your organization? What are your needs? Do you understand the individuals you are supervising or working with, or interacting with in terms of their needs and goals? What questions can you ask them to obtain more information? Will negative or positive feedback directed at the employees help solve the problem you are working on? Have you been giving accurate and useful feedback to the relevant individuals? Did you inadvertently create the motivational problems in the employees or the people you are dealing with by inadvertently transmitting the wrong message? If this is a possibility, how can you correct it? Can you set precise goals that will alleviate the motivational problem? Can you delineate your current life situation in terms of Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs? What need level are you at currently? What are the needs that you focus most of your efforts on? Can you delineate the needs of your employees or the people you are interacting with in terms of Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs? What needs do they focus on? Can you answer the above questions in terms of the ERG theory? In terms of McClellan theory of needs, how significant are your needs for achievement, power, and affiliation? Can you answer the above question in relation to your employees or the people you are interacting with?